Hi there, dolls, music lovers, and fashion enthusiasts. Welcome to Unveiling the Legends, Dolls of the 60s and 70s, the podcast that takes you on a groovy journey through the lives and legacies of the incredible women who shaped these iconic decades. We are your hosts, Emma
and Abby,
and together we'll explore the stories behind the music, the fashion, and the cultural revolution that defined an era.
Each episode will shine a spotlight on a remarkable woman, from rock and roll rebels to fashion icons, and dive into their impact on the world. We'll uncover the historical context, chat with experts, and celebrate the lasting influence of these trailblazing ladies. So, grab your bell bottoms and get ready to rock and roll as we uncover the untold stories of dolls who left their mark. Let's dive in.
How have you been? What's going on?
I have a surprise for you.
I love surprises.
We talk about like little things on the daily. I send you pictures of my dog and
I love
tell
your
you
dog.
What's going on in these. Buddy is so cute.
He's the cutest.
But Buddy is not the surprise. The surprise is, now I've been sitting on this for a week, I started watching Twin Peaks.
Isn't it the best TV show you've ever seen?
I love it.
It's so good.
Oh my God.
I knew you would appreciate it. This is so exciting. Yes, I'm so excited.
And I'm watching for the first time ever.
It's so good.
I just finished the first episode of season two last night. I'm still grappling with like what's going on at the moment. I feel like I'm watching it with my best friend too. He doesn't know how anything ends, but I do. And he said so perfectly, he said, the vibe of season two, episode one is season one staring at you uncomfortably long.
I love everything about Twin Peaks. It is so perfect. I love how it like lives in its own world. It is so, I know it was filmed in the late 80s, early 90s, and it is set in that time, but it does feel so nostalgic to me because it does kind of like create its own time path for me. It's such a good show. The only thing that I'm not too happy about, there's a film and then there's also a new series. And I think that like David Lynch had planned this. There's like a series, the third season, that takes place 30 years later. It's completely different. And I like the idea of like giving the whole show a new spin, but it did not do the same for me as the first two seasons did. So I'm excited to know what you're thinking.
I'm really enjoying it so far. I'm pretty sure there was a fish in the percolator is one of the greatest line deliveries I have ever seen.
It's so good.
Nothing could have prepared for me.
But I just love how David Lynch creates characters because they're all so unique. I feel like sometimes when you watch TV shows, some characters feel like they were just written in because someone was missing. And with David Lynch's writing and his way of directing, every single person has this huge backstory, this full character and everything. And I adore that. It's like down to the last bit, it's perfect.
Yeah, the lore between Ed and Nadine and
yes.
Norma, and I just learned of all of that.
It's so good.
I even love the log lady.
She's the best. She's the best. I have the first two I have everything on DVD, but like the first two seasons too. And you can watch it without the log lady. And whenever I open the DVD menu, I'm like, who does that?
I started watching it on Pluto, and then I watched season two on Paramount now because, boo, they took everything off Pluto. My versions don't have the log lady introductions. I have the original episodes.
That is wild. I always thought it came with that originally, but maybe it didn't.
But Jack, he's watching it with the log lady introductions.
I mean, you're not really missing any of the plot if you don't watch the log lady, but it's such a fun add-on.
And she kind of says cryptic things that hint at future episodes.
Yes.
And I do kind of feel like I'm missing out on that.
Yeah. I feel like once you've watched through it once and then you watch it back with the log lady, you're like, that's what she was trying to say. It like all clicks.
Well, that'll be no problem for me. I will certainly get around to watching Twin Peaks plus yes. Log Lady, because this show is so rewatchable.
Isn't it? I watch it like once a year at least. I can always just watch it over and over again. It's so fabulous.
I knew you would appreciate me watching this.
Of course. It's funny that we're talking about something that I have been talking to you and like praising for such a long time, because I feel like today's doll is kind of the same. We've been talking about this woman mm-hmm. ever since the first season, basically. She's always been on the list, and I'm so excited to finally bring her story. I've been wanting to tell this doll's story for the longest time. She's often looked over or forgotten, and her life is shrouded in mystery. She was the first black model to be featured on the cover of a major fashion magazine, a groundbreaking moment that should have cemented her place in history. Yet, Donyal Luna remains a whisper in the wind, a fleeting image of striking beauty and enigmatic presence. Her story is one of reinvention, of escaping a difficult past through the creativity of a dazzling persona. It's a story of triumph and tragedy, of a woman who defied expectations and pushed boundaries, only to be consumed by the darkness that haunted her. Donyal Luna wasn't just a model. She was an artist, a muse, a symbol of a changing world. But beneath the surface of glamour and success lay a complex and vulnerable woman, struggling with insecurities and searching for acceptance. This is her story, a story that deserves to be told, a story that deserves to be remembered. Before we get into this, I want to thank Abby for watching the Donyal Luna documentary for me. I've been trying to get my hands on it for almost a year now, but unfortunately it's only available on HBO, which is only available with an American credit card. So thank you, dear Abby. I couldn't have wrote this without you.
One of the advantages of having international hosts. If yes. one of us can't find a source, the other one probably can. That was
yeah.
for both the Nico and your Ushi episodes. You were yes. translating stuff. Peggy Ann Freeman was born on August 31st, 1945 in Detroit, Michigan, to working class parents Nathaniel and Peggy, or Big Peggy as she was now called. Little Peggy was one of three daughters, the middle sister of Josephine and Lillian. Nathaniel moved to Detroit from Georgia as part of the Great Migration, a wave of children and grandchildren of former slaves moving north to find work. It's important to remember that when Little Peggy was born, Detroit was one of the centers of American culture and industry. Come the 1960s, it had Motown, jazz clubs, and, of course, the auto factories. It's not called the Motor City for nothing. It was a popular place to move. Big Peggy, of African-American and German descent, found a job as a secretary for the Young Women's Christian Association, while Nathaniel worked at Ford. The Freemans' marriage was tumultuous. Both had strong personalities. They divorced and remarried 4 times. Alcoholism ran in Nathaniel's family. No one spoke about it, but he was violent towards Big Peggy. Despite this, Little Peggy and her sisters had a financially stable upbringing in a middle-class neighborhood on Scotton Avenue. Nathaniel often took the girls to the movies. In the summer, he took them swimming at Detroit's Kronk Gym. Growing up, Lillian always felt like she wasn't pretty enough. She had her dad's dark skin, while Little Peggy had lighter skin like their mom. Their mom's skin was so light that Lillian said she looked like Queen Elizabeth. Though they had things to do, Big Peggy was very strict, forbidding dances, roller skating, and birthday parties. Rock and roll was out of the question. Lillian said that Little Peggy was, quote, on the bright side of everything, and didn't let anything keep her down for too long. Older sister Josephine says Peggy always knew she was special and thought she'd be an actress. Her favorite movie was West Side Story. Even from a young age, it was clear Little Peggy was going to be different. And she wasn't going to be Little Peggy for very long. She was extremely tall, 5'10" by the time she was 12, with a long neck. She was often rejected by boys who called her names like olive oil. Peggy herself said she was ashamed, almost paranoid, always wishing she could look like someone else, wanting to be a, quote, typical something. But deep down, she really didn't. By 14, she stood an astonishing 6'2", with long limbs and large eyes. She didn't look like anyone else. Though it gave her grief in her childhood, her otherness would later help her career. Peggy attended both Cass Technical High School and the Detroit High School of Commerce, studying data processing at the latter. At Castech, she focused on journalism, performing arts, learning multiple languages, and was a member of the school choir. She graduated from high school early at only 16 or 17 years old. Outside of school, she was active in local community theater and performed at the Experimental Concept East Theater. Her favorite color was yellow. When asked why in a later interview, she called it a, quote, deceiving color. "I am a very deceiving person," she said. Sanders Bryant, a high school friend, met little Peggy in 1962 and noticed her sitting by herself at lunch. But instead of calling herself Peggy Freeman, she introduced herself as Danielle George Luna. She adopted a distinctive speaking style, which her mother described as like she was singing. The origins of the name Luna have been speculated to symbolize her desire for reinvention, or just to reference the space race. She even made up a backstory about a goddess who came to Earth. She faked a vaguely European accent, it's very interesting to listen to, and practiced her signature as an escape from her real life. She had trouble coping after her mother became a single parent. According to her daughter Dream, quote, "With souls like Danielle's, when the sensitivity is too high, you're scared that it's going to suck you in, so you create fairy tales as a way to escape." At various times in her life, Danielle claimed she was of Indian, Spanish, Irish, and Mexican descent. Her father resented the Danielle persona, especially when she claimed she wasn't black. It hurt to see his daughter reject the heritage he was proud of. As for Danielle, Lillian said she didn't give a damn. She held to this persona for the rest of her life, even if close friends still called her Peggy. Some people just know they're gonna be something more. And that was Danielle.
Her sister later described her as, quote, "a very weird child, even from birth, living in a wonderland, a dream." Danielle often crafted elaborate fantasies about her background and identity. It seemed like early on she struggled with parts of her identity, something that would become a huge part of her life. Because she wanted to be an actress but didn't know anyone who was casting for plays or movies, she started writing her own scripts, as an early boyfriend Sanders Bryant recalled. But whenever Danielle could be on stage, she was ready to command attention. She performed in various school productions, taking on roles such as Cherry in Paint Your Wagon, Ariel in The Tempest, Chastity in Anything Goes, and Jean in Stage Door. After rehearsals, she would frequent coffee houses near Wayne State University, dressed entirely in black, inspired by the beatnik subculture. On weekends, she often visited Windsor, Ontario, and other parts of Canada. Her eccentricities made her stand out, with Roland Charette, managing director of Detroit Civic Center Theater, remembering her as a cook for her habit of walking barefoot, even on city streets. During the 1963 run of Paint Your Wagon, she was known to feed popcorn to pigeons during outdoor rehearsals. Looking back on her time in Detroit compared to her later experiences in Europe, she remarked, quote, "Back in Detroit, I wasn't considered beautiful or anything." A former classmate at Castech, Verna Green, recalled, "She was such a striking image. I couldn't forget her. She looked like an oddball to the run-of-the-mill student. Not enough people had told her how strikingly beautiful she was." Danielle was not particularly fashion conscious during this period, typically wearing, quote, "simple black skirts and long loose-leaved tops." Reflecting on her school year, she admitted, "I wasn't accepted because I talked funny, I looked funny, and I was a weirdo to everyone. I grew up realizing I was strange." When she was 14, near Detroit's Fisher Building, Danielle met English photographer David McCabe. She was in her school uniform when he came up to her to talk to her. She didn't know it yet, but this meeting would change her life. He encouraged her to move to New York City to pursue modeling. But her mother was hesitant, suggesting instead that she become a nurse. Danielle, determined to follow her dreams, eventually convinced her mother, who arranged for her to live with an aunt near New York Harbor in New Jersey. A year later, in the autumn of 1964, just after the Civil Rights Act was passed, she turned 19 and finally moved to New York City. A year later, the signing of the Voting Rights Act allowed Black Americans to vote, a great victory for the Civil Rights Movement. However, just 1 year later, the assassination of Malcolm X shook the world, highlighting how the fight for equality was far from over. Opportunities for non-white models were extremely limited. Her daughter later wrote, quote, I'm still amazed at how brave my mother was to leave home for Manhattan at that point in history, with no clear plans or steady income, just a telephone number hastily written down by a stranger, as a girl of color at the time, simply believing in her own worth and following her true calling were great revolutionary acts.
Danielle initially worked as a junior secretary at an electronic cabling firm on Varick Street. After joining an actors' union, she moved into an apartment on Broadway, sharing the space with a roommate. Her sister Lillian later recalled, quote, "She packed so little, it seemed like she was going on an overnight trip rather than to live in New York." Danielle wrote to Marianne, her childhood friend, just after she moved, saying, "New York is a dream. A man danced me down Fifth Avenue, and all up and down Broadway, men were eyeing and whistling at me. As soon as possible, I'll send you a picture of the new me. I'll be on top of the world if it takes every breath I have, every muscle of my skinny body. I feel it. I know it. I'll be some kind of star real soon." Once she left Detroit, there was no going back. By October of 1964, Danielle reconnected with David McCabe, who sent her photographs to various agencies. He introduced her to Harper's Bazaar editor Nancy White, fashion photographer Richard Avedon, and senior fashion editor China Machado. White signed Luna to an exclusive contract for the remainder of 1964, while Avedon took on the role of her manager. Her first modeling job was a Mademoiselle shoot featuring Woody Allen. The following month, she moved from her aunt's home into an apartment on Broadway. That same year, Danielle walked her first runway show. She witnessed American journalists spitting in the designer's face because he chose to only feature black models on the runway.
I feel like at this point, it is important to talk about what the modeling industry was like when Danielle entered the scene. In the early and mid-1960s, the beauty standard was fully Eurocentric. Women like Twiggy and Patty Boyd, with their blonde hair and pale complexion, were deemed the picture of beauty, and black models weren't seen anywhere. Their roles were reserved to be in magazines like Ebony, catered towards black women. If featured in mainstream media, black models in the fashion industry were often confined to a racial script that brought together both primitivism and modernity as the material precondition for participation within the industry, portraying them as exotic and noble savages from primitive African cultures. This relegated them to outsider status. As Bridget Keenan observed before Danielle, black individuals in fashion photos were often relegated to the background as props. She cited Bonnie Ilvertson's 1958 placement on a foldout designed for easy removal by potentially offended readers. Danielle faced racism wherever she went. No black model had ever been on the cover of any major magazine, and despite her outstanding beauty, she had a hard time finding work. Danielle knew she had to break down many barriers to get the same opportunities as white models. She had a complicated relationship with her racial identity, frequently distancing herself from discussions about race. Many who knew her recalled that she didn't identify strongly with blackness, which sometimes led to tension. In a 1968 interview with the New York Times, when asked if she considered herself black, she responded, "I prefer to think of myself as a human being, the same as everybody else." This was reflective of her broader outlook. She seemed uninterested in being defined by race, which contrasted sharply with the civil rights movement happening around her. Even later on, despite her success, Danielle's relationship with race remained complicated. She often denied being black, claiming instead to be of various mixed ethnicities, Polynesian, Mexican, and even from the moon itself. She invented elaborate backstories, telling interviewers she had three brothers in a band and that she ate 3 kilos of meat a day, and that she came from Boston. She said, "I've been described as both a white person and a Negro. Whatever people want to think, they can." None of it was true, but the media accepted these stories without question. Her refusal to acknowledge her black identity alienated her from the black community. At a time when the civil rights movement was at its peak, when figures like Malcolm X were urging black people to embrace their heritage, Danielle was doing the opposite. She wanted to exist beyond race, to be seen as a fantastical being rather than a black woman. This rejection of identity was deeply controversial and contributed to her erasure from the broader narrative of black fashion history. In an interview, she once said she, quote, "wished she was white and blonde and blue-eyed. It honestly pains me so much that this beautiful woman never felt beautiful enough the way she was.
And even on her biggest magazine covers, as we'll hear through the rest of this episode, efforts were made to conceal that she was Black.
Yes. It is so hard for me to wrap my mind around that, because nowadays, Black people are often still underrepresented in media.
Absolutely.
But not to that degree, I think. She was the first person to have a career like that as a Black woman. And it pains me so much that for every opportunity she had, she needed to work double, triple, if not more than any other model around her. I wonder whether her struggles with identity weren't that much about being Black and more about her general being. I think it was a mixture of both, because she could have just said, I don't want to be associated with the civil rights movement, but I am from Detroit and I have two sisters. But somehow she always wanted to tell these incredible stories of her life. And that kind of makes me wonder whether she thought the way that she was wasn't enough. Whether she always thought she needed to make herself sound more interesting.
However many setbacks Donyall faced, there were a few who recognized her potential. For the January 1965 cover of Harper's Bazaar, Nancy White commissioned an illustration based on her likeness, replacing a previously planned cover. It had been planned in advance, but after Nancy was introduced to Donyall, she scrapped the old cover. She was fascinated by Donyall's beautiful and unique features. Nancy knew this would be controversial, but she decided to put Donyall on the cover. Though she was drawn in a racially ambiguous way, with lighter skin than she had in real life, Donyall would be the first Black person to appear on the cover in the Bazaar's 98-year history. The issue featured six more illustrations of her. Illustrator Katarina Denzinger recalled creating, quote, a total of 40 brush and ink studies for that session in a one-room apartment on Lexington Avenue, with uniformed police officers present as Donyall modeled for the sketches. The backlash was swift. Southern advertisers and subscribers protested, leading to a loss in revenue for the magazine. Designers Meinbacher and Norman Norrell refused to dress her, and Hearst Communications, parent company of Harper's Bazaar, ended her contract with Richard Avedon. Avedon himself felt that racial prejudice and the economics of the fashion business prevented him from continuing to work with her. Similarly, photographer David McCabe believed that, quote, the magazine world really wasn't ready for photographing beautiful Black women. In the Donyall Luna supermodel documentary, he talked about racial prejudice in the American fashion industry. Since I'm an Englishman, I have none of those feelings. So when I saw her, I just realized what great potential she had. Though his contract with Donyall was terminated, Richard Avedon wasn't about to let the industry stop him from photographing her. In the April 1965 issue of Harper's Bazaar, he put his whole career on the line by photographing her for his What's Happening editorial. She's pictured alongside British star model Jean Shrimpton and Beatles Paul McCartney and Ringo Starr. The feature described Donyall as possessing, quote, the tall strength and pride of movement of a Maasai warrior. The Sarasota Herald Tribune picked up on this description, calling attention to its racial undertones and using the moment to discuss the challenges faced by Black women in modeling. Though there was pushback again, Donyall's career slowly but surely took off. She was working with Avedon, one of the top photographers in the world, who pictured her alongside Bob Dylan. Beyond his studio, Donyall became a part of the glamorous New York social scene. Looking back at photos from her from that era, a time when she attended Motown parties hosted by Sammy Davis Jr., danced with Verushka, took pictures with her too, dined at Miles Davis's brownstone, that had to be a wild dinner, and rubbed shoulders with Andy Warhol, Donyall's daughter Dream wrote, I can simultaneously feel how clearly she belonged there, but also how ahead of her time she was.
I wonder whether she ever met Edie Sedgwick.
That's something to think about.
Because she was in that whole factory scene and Edie was too. It's a little early, but it is kind of the time where Edie was there. It could be.
Donyall would have been like 64, 65 in New York.
Yeah.
Did Edie arrive at the factory in 65 or 66?
I think
65. There is potential for crossover.
So I couldn't find anything, but I was wondering because I feel like these two could have been great friends, because from reading Edie's biography, which her sister wrote, she also had a little bit of a struggle with telling the truth. She also liked to make up stories about her past. And so I wonder whether these two could have become great friends. They kind of seem like a great duo to me.
They are similar. I mean, in the sad respects of really struggling with their sense of self, but also they were drawn to artists. They appreciated art. Edie went to art school. And Donyal was a painter, too. She wasn't just a model. So they're both artistically inclined. They both are very social people. I see the similarities here.
Yeah, and they both have this thing about them that just fascinates people so deeply. They both have that thing where once you look, you cannot look away.
Mm-hmm. Exactly.
Tragedy struck in January of 1965 when her mother fatally shot her father in self-defense after he arrived at their home intoxicated and threatening her. The incident happened just steps away from the family home, and Lillian, who witnessed it, described the shooting as accidental. Danielle did not attend her father's funeral. Following his death and a brief 10-month marriage in New York, Danielle suffered a nervous breakdown and spent time recovering in a hospital at the end of 1965. 2 years later, she told the New York Times that she fled to Europe at the end of 1965 because she felt betrayed by the industry. Quote, "They said beautiful things on one side and turned around and stabbed you in the back." Looking back on her move, she reflected, "I wouldn't have to be bothered with political situations when I woke up in the morning. I could live and be treated as if I felt without having to worry about the police coming along." Frustrated by the barriers she faced in the US, Danielle followed the footsteps of Josephine Baker and other black artists before her. She moved to Europe. Danielle's arrival in London in December of 1965 marked a turning point in her career. While in New York, fashion came down from high fashion magazine editors, in London, fashion came up from streetwear and was mostly dictated by young people.
That's why it's so cool.
Yes.
And the silhouettes are so different, too, because in New York, everything was, I think, very clean lines and very minimalistic, color palette, yes. And in London, the hemlines are rising. You get more frills and ornaments and patterns and fabrics and lots of bright colors.
It makes London fashion feel so much younger than New York fashion. She became a prominent figure in swinging London, a period of burgeoning youth culture that captivated the world. Danielle, alongside other models of color like Kelly Wilson and Hazel Collins, sported the iconic Vidal Sassoon bobs. The city pulsed with mods, teddy boys, and vibrant colors, and unique styles found in shops like Barbara Hulanicki's Biba, and the street culture of Carnaby Street and Chelsea.
Did Danielle ever model for Biba?
I did not find any pictures.
I feel like she should have.
She would have fitted in so well.
Looking at her style through the mid and late 60s, it's very eclectic, very moody, lots of fabric mixing, and lots of interesting jewelry. I noticed in photos she would put like necklaces on her head and wear them as headbands. She would glue gems to her face.
It looks so cool.
Very Biba.
Maybe she just chopped there a lot.
Can we just talk about Big Biba for a second in the Biba boutique? Imagine regular people shopping with celebrities.
The whole boutique.
Like, oh, I just went to the shop the other day and bumped into a top model.
That must have been insane.
That's unheard of today.
She was kind of like just living a regular life, and she loved that too.
Mm-hmm. In London, Danielle was photographed by leading photographers such as David Bailey. I think I sent it in my notes, Emma, but I could not believe they got David Bailey for Danielle Luna Supermodel. He's the photographer the movie Blow Up is based on. We've mentioned this before. He had a habit of having affairs with his models.
He should be part of the bingo sheet at this point.
Yeah. When asked to explain himself, he said, quote, "I just started shooting girls I liked, really." Of course, he liked Danielle. Like fellow British photog Richard Avedon, it didn't occur to Bailey that photographing a black girl would be controversial. Quote, "I didn't even think about her being black. I just thought she was beautiful, and I thought she'd be great for a picture. I never thought about her being black, actually. I just did it." Dunyal also worked with William Klein, Helmut Newton, Charlotte March, and William Claxton. She immersed herself fully in the London art scene, befriending actors and actresses like Julie Christie, Sir Michael Caine, Ian Quarrier, and Yul Brynner. Of course, she also befriended Mick Jagger, add him to the Dolls Pod Bingo as well. Dunyal settled into an apartment near the River Thames with her pet Maltese, Christiane. Being friends with so many actors, Dunyal still longed to be an actress herself. Quote, "I never planned to be a model when I was in Detroit," she said in 1966. "I wanted to be a starving actress in New York." She occasionally appeared on television programs like Late Show London and The Eamon Andrews Show, even appearing on The Tonight Show starring Johnny Carson. In 1966, Richard Avedon submitted Dunyal for American Vogue's Great Fur Caravan shoot. This was a huge campaign, one of Vogue's most iconic shoots of all time, and would have been an incredible opportunity for Dunyal. Diana Vreeland, editor of American Vogue, said no to her involvement. Though Diane always said Dunyal was, quote, too extreme for Vogue, the reality of the situation was a little different. When Avedon asked to bring Dunyal to Japan for the fur caravan, Diana said, quote, "Dick, you can't take Luna to Japan. She's nobody's idea of what anybody wants to look like." Avedon fought for her, asserting she was extraordinary. Diana said, "So was King Kong." Diana refused Dunyal because she was black. Sadly, she was far from the only editor to do this. Dunyal appeared in several Andy Warhol films. I feel like outsiders in New York loved Warhol and his factory.
It was fascinating for sure.
Dunyal appeared in Warhol's Screen Tests, where she was one of only four African-Americans featured. Critic Wayne Kostenbaum described her in the Screen Tests as, quote, "pure diva, presenting a delicious mobile excess of mannerism." In 1965, Dunyal appeared in Warhol's Camp, a film satirizing his own social circle, where she dances to the Ramsey Lewis Trio's The In Crowd in a backless dress and fur stole. She would also appear in the 1967 film Dunyal Luna, a 33-minute color production in which she plays Snow White, complete with blue contact lenses. She wore these contacts in a couple interviews, I think it was, a couple TV spots. Man, they're bright, bright blue. So you see this woman with this big hair, really high forehead, high, high cheekbones, long arms and legs, and these piercing, bright blue eyes. It's almost intimidating.
She surely had her own look.
However, she struggled with how different she looked. She really owned it.
She did.
That's what's so fascinating about her, is she has these two sides in which she wants to blend in, but she is incapable of doing so, and there's this tug of her wanting to stand out and embracing this otherworldly beauty and creating this whole character. Gosh, we're going on. She's just so interesting.
She really is. Just 3 months after arriving in March of 1966, Dunyal achieved a historic milestone, becoming the first African-American model to grace the cover of any Vogue magazine, British Vogue. David Bailey, who photographed her, described her as, quote, "extraordinary looking, so tall and skinny. She was like an illustration, a walking illustration." He admitted, quote, "I didn't care what she was. She could have been a fucking Martian for all I cared." She would have loved that. She would have loved to know you thought like that.
Yeah, I mean, she said once or twice she was from the moon just to mess with people.
While he believed the Vogue House editorial staff was pleased with their choice, he noted that the salespeople always had a problem with using her. Beatrix Miller, the editor of British Vogue at the time, selected Dawn Yahl for, quote, her bite and personality, describing her as happening to be a marvelous shape, all sorts of angular and immensely strange and tall. The cover shot, inspired by Picasso's ocular-centric portraits, featured one of Luna's eyes peered suggestively from between her fingers, which formed a V for Vogue. As her family later revealed, she wore a Chloe dress and Mimi the N earrings. The accompanying editorial showcased her in Christian Dior silk tunics, mod-style dresses by Pierre Cardin, and a silver Yves Saint Laurent dress. Afterwards, the head of Condé, Nast Alexander Lieberman, told Bailey, "Don't ever photograph like that again." Only later did Bailey realize like that was in reference to photographing a black model. The way that these men and women in the fashion industry got so upset about her being there is insane to me. It feels like they're personally offended for some reason.
Yeah, but I love that she had photographers and editors, lower editors, that defied higher orders and just published her anyway because they believed in her.
Yeah. Despite her groundbreaking covers, speculations arose, with some suggesting that the image was angled to obscure Dawn Yahl's features, particularly her lips and nose, thereby, quote, hiding her race and perpetuating featurism and Eurocentric beauty standards. However, her family clarified in 2019 that the focus on the single-lined eye was a deliberate artistic choice. Also in March of 1966, Dawn Yahl appeared in a jewelry spread in the German magazine Twen, photographed by Charlotte March. Her friend and fellow model Pat Cleveland recalled, "She had no tits, but lots of presents. We'd walk down the street and men's mouths would drop open in awe. When we walked into restaurants, people would stop eating and stand up and applaud. She was like a mirage or some kind of fantasy." That same year, she was on the album cover of Easy Walker by jazz saxophonist Stanley Turrentine. Dawn Yahl's work extended to French Vogue as well. Bethan Hardison commented, quote, "No one looked like her. She was like a really extraordinary species." A Time magazine article from 1966 titled The Luna Year described her as a new heavenly body who, because of her striking singularity, promises to remain on high for many a season. Dawn Yahl Luna, as she calls herself, is unquestionably the hottest model in Europe at the moment. She's only 20, a Negro, hails from Detroit, and is not to be missed if one reads Harper's Bazaar, Paris Match, Britain's Queen, the British, French, or American editors of Vogue. She also appeared in London Life magazine, posing as a shop window display model at a Wallace department store in London. Dawn Yahl's modeling career continued to flourish. In April, she reappeared in British Vogue, photographed by David Bailey in a feature called This Summer's Dancing Patterns. She then graced the cover of British Harper's Bazaar in June of 1966, shot by Bill King, her features and skin color clearly visible. In October, she was featured in a William Klein shoot for British Vogue alongside Audrey Hepburn. She really worked with everyone.
Mm-hmm. And everyone wanted to work with her.
Yes.
Dawn Yahl was known for her unique, free-form, hip-popping strut on the catwalk and other unconventional walking styles. Her eccentricity, which stemmed from her acting experience, naturally drew her to visual artists. She incorporated their influences into her own work. She developed what some call method modeling, crafting theatrical catwalk performances. She crawled like a lion, grooved to the music, or suddenly froze and made direct eye contact with journalists. That would be so off-putting, but she had every right to do that. She, quote, "sometimes slithered like a snake, or simply laid down and rolled from one end of the runway to the other." I picture this like Cleopatra unrolling from her carpet.
Mm-hmm.
It's rolling on the floor, but make it fashion.
I cannot imagine her doing anything and not looking incredibly well by doing so.
Mm-hmm.
I imagine her, whatever she did, she looked incredible and better than anyone else.
For anyone wondering how any of this flew, it was the 60s. That's really the only explanation we have. Designers like André Courrèges, Yves Saint Laurent, Rudy Gernreich, Mary Quant and Paco Rabanne, quote, encourage such displays, equating them to their own exuberant designs and to the rebellious conduct of their youthful clientele. Donyall's method acting allowed her body to be viewed as 3D art. Bill Cunningham described her performances, quote, her body moves like a panther, her arms the wings of an exotic bird. The long neck suggests a black trumpet swan. The audience responds with shattering applause for the model's performance rather than the designer's clothes. It is the birth of a new fashion era, that of the spectacular show that rivals any on Broadway. Donyall's striking beauty and ethereal presence captivated the surrealist artist Salvador Dali, who declared her, quote, the reincarnation of Nefertiti. He wasn't the only one to liken her to a goddess. Their collaboration produced iconic images, with Donyall posing on a piano submerged in Dali's pool and modeling a dress he painted on with swirling lines. Her unconventional style and willingness to embrace the eccentricities of the art world made her a perfect muse for Dali. He saw in her a kindred spirit and a reflection of his own surreal vision. Dream later wrote of their relationship, quote, as ever, my mother was propelled forward by her creativity, even in the midst of her success. She traveled to Salvador Dali's home in the Catalonian village of Caraquet, where he promptly declared her one of his muses. Look at the photos of that trip, and you will find my mother cradling the baby ocelot that Dali kept as a pet, or standing on a grand piano in the middle of a lake near his house. The artist had rolled it in there himself. Most beautiful of all are the portraits of her in a cream gown, with Dali sketching directly onto the fabric. In 1967, Donyall moved to Paris, where she and roommate David Crowland ate little more than candy bars and Coca-Cola. Their diet mainly consisted of alcohol and hash. Donyall nicknamed Crowland Baby, and in Donyall Luna Supermodel, he told a story from their days living together in the late 60s. Donyall was tossing what looked like a black softball in the air. She threw it to Crowland, he dodged it. She's like, why didn't you catch it? It wasn't a ball. It was a ball of solid hash. When asked where she got it, by the way, she was like, oh, someone just gave it to me. A softball size of hash would cost you over $1,000, and someone just gave it to her. One night, Donyall and Crowland took LSD together with some of their friends. When no one was looking, she disappeared for 3 days. Crowland thinks she didn't come home because she felt free. In all that time, no one had recognized her. That same year, Adel Rutstein, a leading fiberglass mannequin designer, created a mannequin based on Donyall's striking figure. This Donyall mannequin was meant to capitalize on the success of the Twiggy mannequin, which sold countless dresses to teen girls in the mid-60s. Adele paid Donyall $105 per hour, equivalent to $830 today, to pose for him. Donyall briefly returned to New York in September of 67, where her roommates recalled her making $500 worth of calls to Europe every month. Lester Gaba also made mannequins after her. One with black skin and one with white. Donyall was photographed by Peter Knapp for the Sunday Times, once again wearing Rabanne. She appeared on the March 27, 1968 cover of the British magazine Queen, wearing a head wrap. This is indicative of Afrocentrism coming up through the late 60s and really taking off into the 70s. Before this, Donyall would be pictured either with straightened hair or with lots of wigs. Having a head wrap on the cover of a major magazine like Queen, that was a big deal.
She really broke down all these barriers. After moving to London, she appeared in Michelangelo Antonioni's Blow Up in 1966 and the infamous Rolling Stones Rock and Roll Circus in 1968. She also starred in the French film Who Are You, Polly Magoo from 1966. The film's a spoof of the fashion world and made fun of Diana Freeland, editor of American Vogue, the same woman who'd always tried to keep Donyall out of Vogue. Her only mainstream Hollywood film was Otto Preminger's Skidoo from 1968, where she played Groucho Marx's mistress. Preminger also signed her with MGM. In November of 1968, Danielle and a group including Ian Quarrier and Mia Farrow were asked to leave the Mayfair Cavendish Hotel restaurant at 4 a.m., ostensibly because the men weren't wearing ties. When Quarrier pointed out other tie-less patrons, Danielle questions whether the real reason was her race. The group was ultimately removed by police for causing a disturbance, Danielle arriving in a maroon-colored Rolls-Royce wearing a yellow coat of Mongolian lamb's wool and knee-high blue suede boots, accused the police of lying, but her claims were dismissed. Quarrier, defending Danielle in court, protested when the judge stated, quote, "I am quite sure it had nothing whatsoever to do with Miss Luna's color," shouting from the dock, quote, "That's not true." Quarrier was eventually fined £10 for disturbing the peace. Danielle later told the American press that rowdiness had occurred and that her party was asked to leave, quote, "because I am colored. It was a nightmare. The hotel staff and police were pushing me away. The hotel refused to tell us why we were being thrown out." That same month, she was photographed again for British Vogue by Harry Pettinati. By 1969, she was reportedly earning $1,000 a week. That is around $7,300 in today's money.
I would love to make that in a month.
She was living the high life.
In Paris, Danielle was initially slated to cover Vogue Paris before her British Vogue cover. Edmond Charles Roux had photographed her for the cover, but it was replaced overnight with two white models, reportedly to avoid offending readers.
Oh, boo.
That must have hurt so bad. Charles Roux, who had championed Danielle, was subsequently fired. In 1966, Danielle stated, quote, "Being what I am, I can get what I ask." She modeled for Paco Rabanne's debut show 12 Unwearable Dresses alongside Kelly Wilson. She also worked for Paris Match, posing for 11 different photographers, including shoots on, quote, "the landing gear of an airborne helicopter and underwater." She was shot by Guy Laroche for Match on a skating rink and by Charles Courier in Emmanuel Ungaro. She appeared on the July 1966 cover of Elle, shot by Ronald Traeger, and in a beach shoot with Jill Kennington.
In 1967, in Sydney, she modeled paper dresses for paraphernalia, a popular trend with teenage girls. Paraphernalia dresses are incredibly rare today. They are so cute, but because their quality is comparable to modern fast fashion, they just fell apart. The paper dresses are even rarer for obvious reasons. Danielle also walked the runway in the Danielle Luna Spectacular fashion show, but her personal life was just as complex as her professional one. In the mid-60s, she was briefly married. Subsequent relationships included reported engagements to Austrian-Swiss actor Maximilian Schell, an unnamed Danish photographer, German actor Georg Willing, thank you, and even Brian Jones of the Rolling Stones. However, she didn't fully commit to any of her previous partners. Model Geraldine Smith recalled an incident in 1967 where Danielle had, quote, "this crazy boyfriend who came in and smashed her over the head with a beer bottle, presumably in a fit of jealousy for going on a date with another man." In 68, Danielle was reportedly dating Australian pop artist Martin Sharp. In 69, she was romantically involved with German actor Klaus Kinski, but the relationship ended when he, concerned about the impact of drug use on his career, asked her entourage to leave his home.
This is absolutely insane to me, because Klaus Kinski was notorious for screaming and having full-blown meltdowns at sets. He was such a difficult character that even though he was a great actor, in the end, no one wanted to work with him anymore. Honestly, you have to go to YouTube and just type in Klaus Kinski breakdown. It is wild. He behaves like a 5-year-old.
I'm imagining like Gordon Ramsay levels of swearing, but
he's like screaming and jumping. It's almost funny. It is so insane.
Why are people like that?
I have no idea.
He was just crashing out on sets, and for what?
Yes.
In Italy, Danielle appeared in Amica wearing animal prints and furs, and in Vogue Italia, photographed by Gianpaolo Barbieri. She later modeled in camera ads. She bought her own apartment in Italy in 1970 and often drove her Cinquecento, quote, folding herself into an accordion, squeezing her knees up to her chin to fit in her car. Cars in Europe are so much smaller than cars here, especially now with like the whole I drive giant SUVs thing. How do tall people do it? How do they drive in Europe?
My husband's mm-hmm. really tall. He's like 6'3" or 4" or something. He's quite tall. They just fold in there. I have no idea. I mean, for me, he always fits. I mean, no, he's fine. We don't have... That's, I mean, compared to America, we definitely do have a small car. Compared to, like, other cars, it's okay. I used to work on, like, a TV show where one of the main characters drove a Porsche. And mm-hmm. these cars are so tiny. And even I, getting in there, I was like, ugh, this is such a hassle. Because it is so far down. And
yeah, they're so kind close of, like, to the ground.
Yes, and one time we were shooting that car with an elderly actor. He's like, I don't know, he was maybe 75 or so, and he was quite tall too, and he could not get out of that car anymore. And I felt so bad for him because I was like, I do get it, I'm 20 and it fucking sucks getting out of that car. I'm so sorry, man.
Tales from Emma's film career. I always love hearing them. Soon, Doniol moved to Italy full-time to pursue acting. She sold both her London and Paris properties to finance her move. Doniol had small roles in Dillinger is Dead and Federico Fellini's Satyricon, in which she played a witch. She also appeared in the 1970 documentary Soft Self-Portrait of Salvador Dali and starred in the Italian film Salome in 72. Doniol was very close to co-star Juan Fernandez. Though the press reported they had a relationship on the set of Salome, Juan firmly denied this. In Italy, Doniol met her future husband, photographer Luigi Casagna. The two met at a party in Rome in September of 1969. For the first couple months, communication was a challenge. Luigi only spoke Italian, and Doniol didn't know Italian. He said he, quote, liked her for her love of creativity and for everything that wasn't square. They collaborated on projects like a, quote, hand-illustrated fairy tale, avant-garde film scripts, and beautiful colored prints, all of which remain unpublished. Doniol was considered most creative during this time of her life. She indulged in her love of art, doing lots of painting and journaling. She wrote Lunafly, a largely autobiographical children's book she wanted to publish. In this book, she reflected on her own childhood, her experiences in fashion, her move to Europe, and how forces conspired to keep Black women like her invisible, despite her very visible life. She explored themes of visions, her spiritual visions and those of other Black women, and her pursuit of beauty as art.
Doniol returned to North America several times between 1973 and 1975, working as a runway model in New York, California, and Toronto. She appeared on the cover of Andy Warhol's Interview magazine in October of 1974. In April of the following year, she posed nude for Playboy, photographed by her husband Luigi. It's noted that in the shoot she portrayed, quote, characters of her own devising, as an angel soaring over the Los Angeles skyline, or as a mermaid perched on a rock by the Pacific Ocean.
These photos are in the Doniol Luna supermodel documentary. They are beautiful. In one, this photo, I'm sure you know what I'm talking about, but the listeners, they don't have the pictures. There is the shot where Doniol, it looks like she's suspended in the sky and her arms are these white feathered wings. Mm-hmm. She was so creative. I could have seen her becoming a really wonderful, boundary pushing creative director in the late 70s and early 80s.
Yes. If only she would have gotten there, yeah.
I would have loved that future for her because she had an eye.
Although fulfilling Playboy's prerequisite for female nudity, the photographs were far from titillating or sexually explicit. Doniol seemed not only at ease with her nudity, but completely beyond societal structures and moral rectitude. Her physique in the shoot also defied the magazine's typical portrayal of voluptuous women, emphasizing her smaller build and spiritual vision. However, Danielle's modeling career was declining by this time, partly due to her shift towards acting and partly due to negative media attention surrounding her dependency on drugs like heroin, LSD, pot, and her eccentric behavior. A designer who had once employed her commented, quote, "She took a lot of drugs and never paid her bills." Beverly Johnson, a fellow black model who knew Danielle well, asked in 1975 about other black women like Danielle who had achieved Vogue covers, said of Danielle, "She doesn't wear shoes winter or summer. Ask her where she's from, Mars. She went up and down the runways on her hands and knees. She didn't show up for bookings. She didn't have a hard time. She made it hard for herself." Beverly later acknowledged in 2016 that Danielle had, quote, "made it possible for models like me and others," and that Luna is one of several black models everyone needs to know, being one of those legends in our industry, one of the shoulders I stood on. I feel like this is so important to understand. Even though Danielle struggled with her identity and race, she opened doors for other black models who came after her, even if she herself didn't walk through them. In June of 1975, she attended a Sandra Rhoades show in New York, where she was seen posing in a veiled harem outfit. At the 1973 Cannes Film Festival, Danielle pitched her life story to film executives, including Berry Gordy. She claimed that Gordy's 1975 film Mahogany was based on her pitch.
Danielle married Luigi in California in 1976. The next year, they welcomed their only child, a daughter named Dream. Her name was in part inspired by Martin Luther King's I Have a Dream speech, and part an assertion that Little Dream was a dream come true for her parents. Luigi's Polaroids captured glimpses of Danielle's everyday life, in her car, at home in the kitchen, on the beach. Luigi built a home in the Italian countryside for them as a symbol of their love, but it couldn't mask underlying issues. Even seemingly beautiful moments like Luigi bringing her champagne, flowers, and a joint after she gave birth were intertwined with the complexities of their life together. Luigi's family rejected Danielle. She openly smoked weed, and his family was very Catholic. Danielle even said in an interview once that she wanted to, quote, "spread marijuana over the Vatican." She was clearly joking, but his parents were not about this. At a certain point, Dream went to live with Luigi's parents, while Danielle and Luigi went back to Rome. The pressure of their unstable home life on top of her infamy and declining career became unbearable for Danielle. She broke down in front of her friend Pat Cleveland, confessing, "I'm just a girl from America. Can you save me?" It was a cry for help. Pat was shocked. Danielle was like an invincible goddess to her. That night, her illusion shattered. Pat suggested she go home, but Danielle said she couldn't. On May 17, 1979, Danielle gave Dream to her nanny for the night. She hurried across the street, dodging traffic to do so. Those close to her wonder if this was a passively suicidal action. As Luigi's parents forbade Danielle from staying in their home with him, she was staying with a friend. This friend discovered Danielle motionless in her room. She called Luigi. He arrived on the scene at the same time as the police, but it was too late. Danielle Luna had passed away that night at the age of 33. Her cause of death was determined to be a heroin overdose, which those close to her have always found strange. Though she indulged in weed and occasionally psychedelics, she stayed away from heroin. Luigi thinks, because they didn't have the money to buy weed or hash at the time, that she simply took whatever was given to her on the street. Juan Fernandez refuses to believe she overdosed. David Crowland, on the other hand, refuses to believe Danielle was suicidal, attributing her death to her heart simply giving out. Dream was only 18 months old when her mother passed. After this, she was primarily raised by Luigi's parents. They rarely spoke of her after she died, but when Dream asked about her mom, they told her she died of a broken heart. Dream still holds this belief. Though she never really knew her mother, Dream feels her presence every day. Quote, "Whenever I was looking at the moon, I thought that was my blessing from her."
I would like to end this episode by reading you a piece written by Dream reflecting on her mother's life and legacy. My mother's death in 1979 was a tragic accident. Despite stories in the press about the last years of her life, my father has told me that she was dynamic and creative until the end. I see how true that is when I look at photographs of her stretched out theatrically on top of a pile of notebooks and diaries on a Long Island beach. You can feel how vibrant, present, and totally connected to life she was. She leaves behind a great story, one that I am proud to tell my daughters. On May 17, it'll be 46 years since my mother left us. On that day, I will honor her legacy and reflect on her memory with my family. Most of all, though, I will be hoping that the world is finally ready to celebrate a young African-American girl from Detroit who didn't let others define her. In the end, these pages contain many of the real facts about her extraordinary life, and this is how she deserves to be remembered at last.
Thanks for tuning in to this episode of Unveiling the Legends, Dolls of the 60s and 70s. We hope you enjoyed our journey through the life of the otherworldly Donyal Luna.
As always, we're Emma
and Abby,
your hosts, and we're thrilled to have you with us on this groovy adventure. Remember, the spirit of these trailblazing ladies lives on in each one of us, inspiring us to embrace our individuality, creativity, and passion for change.
If you like what you heard, don't forget to subscribe to, rate, and review our podcast on your favorite streaming platform. Your feedback means the world to us, and it helps others discover the magic of these legendary dolls.
As always, we'd like to thank special friend of the show, Michael Teggio, for the wonderful intro song. Until next time, keep the music loud, the fashion groovy, and the spirit of the 60s and 70s alive in your hearts.
Peace,
love,
and rock and roll.